Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 515 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, we're going to be addressing a topic that I title Ventilator Physiology Part 2. Ventilator Physiology Part 2. This is a continuation of episode 65 that deals with Ventilator Physiology Part 1. So in today's podcast, we're going to be talking about some systems of ventilation that I think will be helpful to you for your USMLE exams. And not just for your USMLE exams, but just for general understanding of ventilators. Although please again remember, these podcasts are solely for educational purposes. They are not for medical decision making or anything like that. So let's jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a 31-year-old male and you're told that his BMI is 32? And that he has been queried multiple times at his place of work because he has been found to be falling asleep. If you think about that, what should you think? I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like obstructive sleep apnea. Right? You're going to see that in a person that is obese, the person snores, the person has a short, thick neck sometimes. Many times you'll notice that those people, they feel very tired during the day. And many times you're going to notice that people that have sleep apnea, at night they'll have hypercarbia because they're holding on to CO2. They're not able to blow off that CO2 very well at night, so they have hypercarbia. Although usually during the day they're completely fine. Although, if you notice that a person has like deep time hypercapnia, then and the person is obese, has the classic sleep apnea symptoms, where you notice that, wow, this person seems to have hypercapnia during the day, then one thing you absolutely positively want to think about is the person potentially having something I like to call obesity hypoventilation syndrome. And remember, when a person has sleep apnea, you're obviously going to diagnose it with a sleep study. You're going to perform polysomnography, and then you're going to treat it with CPAP or BiPAP. You know, you can also recommend lifestyle modifications like lose weight and things like that. So let's kind of talk about this whole CPAP business. I think that's something that's kind of important to understand. Really, today, honestly, I want to focus on two things. I want to focus on CPAP and I want to focus on PEEP. I want to focus on those two things because there are actually quite a number of ways they can integrate it on the exam. So what does CPAP stand for? Well, CPAP literally means continuous positive airway pressure. Continuous positive airway pressure. Like literally the name essentially tells you what it does. First thing to understand with CPAP and BiPAP, honestly, it's kind of like the same thing. So I'm going to pretty much lump both together. But basically, these are non-invasive methods of ventilation. So you're not ramming a tube down a person's throat when you're doing CPAP. That's one. Number two is that, look at the name, continuous positive airway pressure. So that means you're trying to keep a positive airway pressure. And let me say something. Whenever you see the term positive airway pressure, it means you're getting some kind of pressure that is above atmospheric pressure. Remember, this is one thing that many people are lost on with pulmonology, is that when airway pressures are defined in pulm, they're defined with respect to airway pressure, with respect to atmospheric pressure. Atmospheric pressure is taken as a pressure of zero. So we all know that atmospheric pressure, you know, it's obviously elevation dependent. But at sea level, for the most part, is 760 millimeters of mercury. That 760 millimeters of mercury is set as a zero in pulmonology world. So in saying positive airway pressure, that means, oh, they are setting this person's airway pressure to be at some value that is over 760 millimeters of mercury. In fact, let me tell you this. If you're told that, ooh, a person's airway pressure is set at 5 millimeters of mercury, like let's say their CPAP or whatever is set to 5, if it's in millimeters of mercury, obviously, you know, that's telling you that basically these people's airways are kept at 765. Okay, so again, the zero point is 760 millimeters of mercury, and then it's usually kept above that. So again, continuous positive airway pressure, again, the first thing you need to understand is that the airway pressure is kept positive, is some value above atmospheric pressure. That's number one. Number two is that the fact that this airway pressure is continuous, is continuously positive. So the fact that they use the term continuous means that it's something that happens all the time. Like literally, the airway pressure is kept positive all throughout your breathing cycle. Whether you're inspiring or so you're inhaling or exhaling, it doesn't matter. You're literally keeping your airway pressure positive all throughout that period. That's literally what CPAP is. So you may want to ask yourself, why would I want to keep my airway pressures higher than atmospheric pressure? Why do I want to be giving myself these positive airway pressures continuously? Well, there's a few reasons why you would want to do that. Number one, for the person that has obstructive sleep apnea, which is probably the primary person that CPAP is used for, we try to give them these continuously positive airway pressures so that their airways don't collapse. People that have sleep apnea, their airways are prone to collapsing. So you want to try to prevent airway collapse. And you also want to try to keep these people's alveoli open. You want to try to keep the alveoli open. Think about it. If you're giving positive pressure to the alveoli, those positive pressures are going to distend those alveoli. As you distend those alveoli, they're going to be kept open. And if alveoli are open, that means they're open for business. They're going to be available for gas exchange. So this is one of the primary reasons why we're very prone to using CPAP or BiPAP in people that have sleep apnea. But also, we also use it in people that have a COPD exacerbation. In fact, many times when a person has a COPD exacerbation, as you've seen on your exams, those people are going to get bronchodilators, so nebulized bronchodilators and intravenous steroids. But if those things are not helping their symptoms, you then switch to something we love to call on exams, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. Non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. Look at the name, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. That's literally another word for CPAP or BiPAP. Again, the goal is the same. Because remember, people that have COPD, those people, because they have an anti-protease deficiency, those proteases literally will chew up the parenchyma of their lungs. So their lungs and their airway are prone to collapsing. Their lungs and their airways are prone to collapsing on expiration. So that's why over time, because normally think about it, what do you want your airways to do? At least when you're trying to blow out air from your lungs, you're trying to blow out CO2 from your lungs. You want your airway to open up so you can blow out that CO2. But yes, that's right. As you're blowing off that CO2, you're reducing pressure within your airway. So your airway is collapsing. But the thing is, that collapsing is exaggerated in people that have COPD because their airways just can't seem to stay open enough for them to at least blow off that CO2 in the first place. So the thing is, people that have COPD, those CO2s begin to stack up in the alveoli. Oxygen stacks up in the alveoli. As it stacks up, that's why they have that long hyperinflation. So if a person has a COPD exacerbation where they have like just really crazy amounts of hypercarbia, then you want to try to keep those airways open by giving that continuous positive airway pressure, that non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, so they can blow off that CO2. Now, what are some ways they can also test this on exams, right? Many times when they are testing these PEEPs and CPAPs and whatnot, they love to test it in the context of arrows. They'll give you a bunch of arrows and you have to figure out what's going on. Well, let me tell you something. What happens to the lung surface area available? So maybe let me frame it this way, right? So I say they love to test this in the context of arrows. What will happen to the surface area of the lungs that's available for ventilation when you're on CPAP or BiPAP? Well, I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, it's definitely going to increase. Because again, think about it. By literally keeping a person's alveoli open, you have more surface area available for diffusion. So you can already begin to see at the almost like molecular or physical level why CPAP or BiPAP will be helpful. Because if you're keeping your airway open, you're increasing the surface area available for diffusion. By increasing that surface area available for diffusion, you're going to be helping with hypoxemia. Because if you look at, for example, a person that has COPD, one of the primary problems in COPD is that the surface area available for gas exchange is markedly decreased. Because all those proteases that are running amok in a person's lungs, they're literally chewing up the person's alveolar walls, chewing up the elastin and all those things, chewing up all those things. When you chew up lung parenchyma, you're literally chewing up surface area. So that's why CPAP or BiPAP, which again we call non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, is very helpful in these folks. And the thing is, let me ask you this. What happens to your work of breathing if you're under CPAP or BiPAP? Well, guess what? Your work of breathing is going to decrease. That's why, believe it or not, some people that come to the hospital and they're going through a CHF exacerbation, if they are very hypoxemic and diuretics and whatnot is not really helping, one thing that could be done for them is to actually put them on non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. Why? Because it's going to reduce the work of breathing. But again, obviously, in a person that is having a COPD exacerbation as well, the CPAP, BiPAP is also reducing their work of breathing. Again, how is it reducing the work of breathing? It's doing it in one of two ways. Actually, in two ways. So the first way is that literally it's keeping your airways patent. It's keeping your airways open. So because your airways, your alveoli are open, you have more efficient gas exchange. If oxygen is coming into your body easily, then your work of breathing is going to decrease. That's one. Number two, by keeping a person's airway open, then you don't have to supply that energy. Because think about it, you literally have to burn ATP to keep your airways open, to keep your alveoli propped open. So if you think about it, if you have some external machine that is supplying that excess pressure, that extra pressure continuously, then you don't have to invest that much ATP in keeping that person's airway open. Now, you can already begin to imagine that, oh, Divine has already said that this is helpful for people that have OSA. This is helpful for people that have a COPD exacerbation. But can you imagine another group of people that would find this to be helpful, especially kids? I hope you're saying, oh, Divine, yeah, this is going to be respiratory distress syndrome. Absolutely, yes. So kids that have respiratory distress syndrome, you know, many times they have to get intubated. But honestly, there are actually quite a good number of kids that do well with non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. In fact, there are studies that have shown that in neonatal respiratory distress syndrome, the use of CPAP or BiPAP reduces the risk of bronchopulmonary dysplasia. Because remember, bronchopulmonary dysplasia is where you have barotrauma, you have free radical injury from oxygen because you've gotten prolonged oxygen therapy in the setting of neonatal respiratory distress syndrome. Your risk of bronchopulmonary dysplasia actually decreases if you use CPAP or BiPAP because, again, those things are non-invasive. And also, believe it or not, CPAP has been shown to improve survival in people that have neonatal respiratory distress syndrome. Remember, our friends at the MBMEs, whenever there is something that improves survival, they love you to know those things for the purposes of your exams. So I'd know these things if I were you. And actually, you know, I'm just trying to supply some vignettes, some things that you may see tested on your exam so you don't get caught down by those. But if they ask you, which of the following interventions is the most effective in treating obstructive sleep apnea? Number one, they'll put weight loss. Number two, they'll put, you know, non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, or they can put CPAP or BiPAP. Number three, they can put some other thing or whatnot. If you see those options, what should you pick? I really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, it's going to be the CPAP option. CPAP is the most effective therapy in managing obstructive sleep apnea. It's even more effective than weight loss. Just going to keep that at the back of your mind because weight loss kind of sounds cool, kind of sounds good, and obviously it's helpful. If you lose weight, then some of the fat that lines your airway is going to go away. That's going to stent open your airway. But CPAP is the most effective intervention for treating obstructive sleep apnea. Now, one thing you may see on exams, especially the higher level exams, I'll say probably like in step 3 world or step 2 world, or if you're like an internal medicine resident or whatever, you're taking your IM boards or your family med boards, then there are some contraindications, or you're taking the emergency medicine shelf exam, you certainly want to know the contraindications to CPAP. What are the contraindications? Number one, if a person has altered mental status, if a person is not able to protect their airway, let's say they've had a stroke or whatever, you have no business putting those people on CPAP. Also, if the person is not very cooperative, if the person is anxious, if the person is thrashing all over the place, if a person is delirious, if a person is going through alcohol withdrawal, those people certainly should not be on CPAP because they're not going to keep it on their face. They'll be thrashing all over the place. It will not be as effective, and they could also injure themselves. And then obviously, if a person has some kind of facial trauma, it makes absolutely no sense to basically put a mask on their face, delivering high-pressure air to their airway. Doesn't make any sense. So let's say a person has been a victim of a burn wound, or they have facial trauma, facial fractures or whatnot. It makes absolutely no sense to put those people on CPAP. Okay, so now let's go to the second part of this presentation, which is probably going to be a little shorter, but this one is going to involve a ton of physiology, so kind of keep your ears open. But I want to talk about PEEP, positive end expiratory pressure. Positive end expiratory pressure. I'm going to talk about some differences between this and CPAP or BiPAP, and then I'm going to try to make some integrations, some USMLE relevant integrations. But basically, PEEP is something that we describe with reference to mechanical ventilation, to invasive ventilation. So CPAP, BiPAP were methods of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. PEEP is an example of invasive positive pressure ventilation. Okay, that's number one. So you're usually going to do PEEP in the context of having an endotracheal tube rammed down your throat. Number two difference is that in CPAP or BiPAP, again, look at this, continuous positive airway pressure. So it's continuous for CPAP. It's throughout your breathing cycle, inhalation, exhalation. But in PEEP, look at the name, positive end expiratory pressure. So that positive pressure is only delivered at the end of expiration. I'm going to say that again. In PEEP, that positive airway pressure is delivered only what? At the end of expiration. It is not delivered throughout your breathing cycle. So that's one very critical difference. You don't get PEEP on inhalation. You get it only on exhalation. Although there are many other permutations of these things, and maybe in the future we can talk about it. Like, I'm sure you've heard of pressure support and all these ventilator modes. Those are things that can be described later down the line. But let's kind of start at the basic. PEEP, PEEP, PEEP. So that positive pressure is delivered at the end of expiration. And why do you think we would really want to target the end of expiration as a time to deliver positive pressures? Well, the thing is, at the end of expiration, your alveoli are especially prone to collapse. Because think about it. Think of a balloon. If you deflate a balloon and get all the air out of it, that balloon is not going to be inflated. That balloon is going to be what? It's going to be deflated. So the thing is, if that balloon is deflated and you want to reinflate that balloon, you have to put in energy and work. You have to blow air with energy into that balloon to keep it open. You can already begin to see that if a person has an increased work of breathing, that's not very favorable. I mean, if a person is a normal human being, doesn't have any OSA or whatever, or COPD exacerbation or ARDS or whatever, then yeah, it's not a big deal. They can supply that energy. But if your alveoli are really collapsed, and let's say you also have a surfactant deficiency, like in NRDS or in ARDS, then your alveoli are like super, super collapsed. To get them open again, you're going to have to put in so much energy and effort that you may not necessarily have. And also, you have to put in more energy and effort than is necessary because you don't have enough surfactant to at least help you counter some of those by keeping your alveoli open, by reducing those surface tensions, right? So, because think about it also. For a balloon, if you have a balloon that is completely deflated, just to get that balloon going, just to get it inflated a little bit, you have to put in a lot of energy. Although, as that balloon gets inflated, you notice that it becomes easier and easier to just keep inflating. Although, when that balloon also gets to a point where it's like quite inflated, you have to also have to use higher and higher amounts of energy to inflate that balloon some more. I think that's actually a very important concept to get down with pulmonology. Honestly, this is why pulmonology is probably one of the most difficult areas of physiology. Actually, it's more difficult than renal, believe it or not. It's more difficult than cardio, believe it or not, at least in my estimation. I feel like many people don't give pulm enough credit, but pulm, people really struggle with pulm. Let me explain something. There are three phases to this thing. I'm just think of this as divine's three phase of opening up your life theory or hypothesis, whatever. But basically, there is the point where you have, so your starting point is, wow, you have this alveoli that's completely deflated. You have that. So if you have a completely deflated alveoli, you want to, there's this point of initial inflation just to open it up. There's this point of it's been inflated and you're just inflating it some more. And then there's this third point of, ooh, it's quite inflated. It's kind of getting to its limit and you want to inflate it some more. In the middle, when the alveoli has been inflated a little bit and you need to inflate it more, it's very easy to inflate. You don't have to use as much energy. But you use the most energy at the first and the third parts of this inhalation cycle. So the completely deflated alveolus that you just want to inflate a little bit, you're going to need a lot of energy. Again, think of a balloon. When you're just completely deflated balloon, you're just inflating it. You need so much energy for that. That's one of the big areas that we target with PEEP. PEEP. Because at the end of exhalation, your lung is very close. Your alveoli are very close to this first rung on the ladder that I've just described. The third rung on the ladder where your alveoli are like very inflated. Your alveoli are very inflated. Your airway is very inflated. And you're trying to inflate it some more. That's where people that have really nasty COPD are. They have lung hyperinflation. So this is why they have such a big time hard work of breathing. Because their lungs are so inflated. And they're taking in deep breaths. They're inhaling. And they're trying to inhale a balloon that is already very distended. Very inflated. That's why they have a high work of breathing. But again, generally in terms of PEEP, we're working on the lower rung of the ladder where we just want to, instead of your alveoli being complete, because think about it again, that first rung on the ladder, alveoli completely collapsed. Man, I got to put in all this work to keep them inflated. That's where PEEP comes in. If you have positive and expiratory pressure at the end of expiration where your lungs are just so prone to collapsing, if you have that positive pressure delivered then it's almost like you're taking the alveoli away from that first rung on the ladder and you're putting it in the second rung on the ladder. By putting it in the second rung on the ladder, then you're noticing that, oh, I don't have to expend as much energy to inflate those alveoli, which is very, very helpful. This is very, very helpful in people that have like a nasty COPD exacerbation or neonatal respiratory distress syndrome. Acute respiratory distress syndrome. By supplying that PEEP, that positive pressure at the end of expiration, you're keeping the alveoli a little bit open. It's almost like instead of getting a completely deflated balloon in your lungs, you're keeping that balloon just a little bit open so that if you need to inflate it again at the next inhalation, it's not as hard. And most times when people are placed on ventilators, the PEEP is set to 5. That's like the default setting for many people. But if a person has like ARDS or NRDS or whatever, then typically you have to set that PEEP above 5. Although you also want to be careful because you can already begin to think that, I don't want to set this thing at unlimited PEEP. Because if you set it at like a very high PEEP, then there is the risk of barotrauma. The person's alveoli will literally pop and explode. And that's probably not a good thing. So again, what are some integrations that could be drawn with PEEP on your exams? So number one, they can ask, they can make it an arrow. If a person is on PEEP, let's start simple. What will happen to the intraalveolar pressures at the end of expiration? Well, I hope you're saying it's gonna increase. Literally, you can get that from the name. Positive end expiratory pressure. Okay. Now, what happens to your venous return when you have PEEP going? What happens to your venous return? Well, your venous return is going to decrease. Why? Because by having that positive pressure on your alveoli a little more distended, they're taking up more space that should be taken by the heart. So they are basically, by having those distended alveoli, they're pretty much causing an extrinsic compression of the heart. If your heart is being compressed from the outside, then it's going to be at higher pressures than is normal. And if your heart is at higher pressures than are normal, then it's not going to be able to receive that much extra blood back in. So your venous return is going to plummet. Okay, now if your venous return decreases, what happens to your cardiac output? Obviously, by decreasing venous return, you're decreasing preload. If you're decreasing preload, your cardiac output is going to go down. And what is one other way they can actually test this cardiac output of a thing? The thing is, our friends at the NBMEs, again, they're beginning to work against these memorizers. So instead of writing it as cardiac output, you can write it as cardiac index. Your cardiac index is literally your cardiac output divided by your body surface area. So obviously, if your cardiac output is going down, your cardiac index will go down as well. So your cardiac index goes down in a person that has a PEEP that's going on. And then what happens to your left pressures on the left side of your heart, like your pulmonary capillary wedge pressure? Well, your pulmonary capillary wedge pressure is going to be decreased. Because again, think about it. If you're distending the lungs, if you're literally distending the alveoli, then those alveoli that are distended are going to be compressing. They're going to be compressing, okay? They're going to be compressing on your pulmonary vessels. When you compress on the pulmonary vessels, you're not going to be getting much blood back to the left side of the heart. And also, again, just for preload decreased reasons or venous return decreased reasons, as I've already defended, you're not getting much blood back into the heart. So there's just not going to be much that's going to be fed from the right side to the left side of the heart. So you're going to have a decrease in your pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. That's very important to know for your exams. Okay, so let me ask you this. If a person is on PEEP, what is going to happen to their intrathoracic pressures? Well, their intrathoracic pressures are going to go up because, again, you're literally bubbling extra air into a person's lungs and keeping those person's lungs inflated, right? Again, because you're bubbling extra air, you're just literally putting more air in the person's thoracic cavity. That's going to raise the intrathoracic pressure. You can already begin to see that, oh, wait, yeah, if my intrathoracic pressure is elevated, well, obviously, my preload is going to go down, my venous return is going to go down, right? Because again, that increase in intrathoracic pressures, believe it or not, is also compressing your SVC and your IVC. Those are the vessels that bring blood back to the right side of your heart. That's going to crush your SVC, IVC. That's going to kill your preload. It's going to kill your venous return. So let me ask you this, though. What happens to your functional residual capacity when a person is on PEEP? Well, your FRC is going to go up because, again, you're supplying positive pressure to the lungs. By supplying that positive pressure to the lungs, you're going to distend your alveoli. By distending your alveoli, you're keeping them at higher volumes. So you're going to have an increase in your functional residual capacity. And then there's this one that may be a little challenging for people to understand, and I can see why people get this wrong on an exam. What happens to your central venous pressure when you're on PEEP? What happens to your CVP while you're on PEEP? Well, what is CVP? Central venous pressure literally stands for right atrial pressure. Why? Here's the way I think about it. Your right atrium is like a central hub for your veins. Pretty much every vein in your body, with some exceptions, drain into the right atrium. So I think of the right atrium as a central hub for the veins. So it makes sense that the right atrial pressure will be called central venous pressure. Central venous pressure. So you will think that, oh, Divine, you've already explained and defended that if a person is on PEEP, their preload goes down, their venous return goes down. Well, since their venous return is going down, blood is not going to be making its way to the right atrium and stuff. So obviously, the right atrial pressures will be decreased. And you would be almost right, but you're wrong. So let me explain. Let me give the answer first. CVP actually goes up. Your central venous pressure is going to go up when a person is on PEEP. So the thing is, there are two effects to consider here. The first effect to consider here is that, first thing we're considering here is that, oh, venous return is going down and preload is going down. So that's going to be, those are going to be factors that are working to decrease your central venous pressure. Okay, but on the flip side, we have this rise in intrathoracic pressure. Like literally, your intrathoracic pressure is going up for reasons I've defended. As your intrathoracic pressure goes up, you're literally going to be pressing the heart from the outside. You're literally going to be contracting the heart from the outside. You're going to be contracting the right side of the heart from the outside. If you remember Boyle's law, I believe from general chemistry, as volume decreases, pressure is going to go down. So you're literally decreasing the volume of the right side of the heart because you're compressing it. As you're decreasing that volume, then the pressure within the right heart is going to go up. So that rise in intrathoracic pressure that is squishing the right side of the heart, that is raising the right atrial pressure, that effect overwhelms the effect of the decreased blood flow to the right side of the heart from the decreased venous return, from the decreased preload. So overall, that contributes to raising the central venous pressure. So please, the central venous pressure with PEEP is increased. The central venous pressure with PEEP is increased, but the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure is decreased. So I know you may be like, Divine, this is kind of confusing. Why would this rise in intrathoracic pressure not also overall cause an increase in pulmonary capillary wedge pressure? Well, let me try to give you a common sense explanation that may help you. One thing that people need to realize is that the right and the left sides of the heart are not really the same in terms of strength. The right side of the heart basically is not as muscular as the left side. In fact, there is a reason why the right side of the heart operates under lower pressures. But the left side of the heart, like the left ventricle, for example, is big, is bigger, is beefier, it's more muscular. So all these external pressures of compression that you may get with an increase in intrathoracic pressure is probably not that big of a deal for a left ventricle, for a left side of the heart. The pressure change, the intrathoracic pressure has to be really extreme for the left heart to start feeling those effects. So that's just something you want to kind of keep at the back of your mind, okay? The right side of the heart is just more easily wigged out by increases in intrathoracic pressure than the left side of the heart. That's just a simple, common sense way to understand that. I'm going to leave it at that. Because again, a person can really get into the weeds with ventilators and these pressures, and then you lose the understanding. The thing is, I don't want you to lose the lesson. I want you to get these points down. There are certain times where a person can go overboard in trying to explain away every single thing, and then the person basically loses the forest for the trees. That's not what I'm trying to achieve here. I'm trying to strike a balance between helping you understand, but also not losing you. So I know some of you may also have this conundrum in your heart that, man, Divine, if a person has like a COPD exacerbation or whatever, and we know that, man, this thing we're doing to them is crushing their preload and crushing their venous return, don't they have any problems with this? Yeah, there are problems with this, right? Because you can already begin to see that, wait, I'm crushing this person's preload, I'm crushing this person's venous return, so I'm crushing their cardiac output, so I'm crushing their blood pressures. So that's why you need to strike a balance. That's why we don't put people on astronomical amounts of CPAP or BiPAP or astronomical amounts of PEEP, because it can cause problems for them. So we need to balance these things. So I think you're already beginning to see, I think this podcast kind of gives you a very nice view of why being a pulmonary critical care doctor is almost like you're literally playing like a balancing act. You're literally trying to balance so many things, because it's almost like you're rubbing Peter here to pay Paul here, rubbing Paul here to pay Peter here. But you're just basically trying to optimize things to a point where the person will do well and you'll solve their most pressing problems. So I'm telling you this, you know, if you're a person that really loves physiology, and you're a person that really loves to be thinking in real time about like what's going on with the patient, what are their vitals telling me, what is this, what is that, pulm critical care is not a bad field to consider, if I'm being completely honest with you. It's almost like anesthesia, but with patients. Don't get me wrong, anesthesiologists obviously work with patients, but let's think of anesthesia, but like in an inpatient setting, not in the operating room. That's what pulm critical care is like. I won't lie, I actually really love pulm critical care as a discipline, because you really have to think and know what you're doing, so you don't kill people. But again, let's go ahead and stop here. I offer review courses for all the USMLE exams. I have a step one class that is starting on Friday of this week. It's a 25-hour class. Many people have taken this class, found it to be helpful. And it's not just for step one, But if you're taking step two or step three and you have a poor basic science foundation, this course will be perfect for you. It's not lectures. It's going to be a lot of scenarios that will help you really reason through the material and build that solid foundation. And then in the month of March, I have a step two, step three class. I have a test-taking class. I have a biostats class. I have a ethics and social science class. I've made a podcast that highlights these classes. Again, they are not lectures. They are scenario-based. They are exam-style questions where I use these questions to teach you the concepts and make integrations and help you understand pathophase. And these classes are for step one all the way to step three. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website. I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams. I have these podcasts on the major podcast apps, Apple, Google, Spotify. I have a YouTube channel you can check out. And then I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week, I post about two podcasts. And from a biblical perspective, I try to address a life lesson. So just check these out. So thank you for listening to me today. My life lesson for you today is to just go about things the right way. Go about things the right way. Sometimes it's easy, or it may seem easier, to take shortcuts to achieve your destiny, but shortcuts will cut you short. Don't get me wrong, there are some shortcuts that are ethical, and obviously there are ethical shortcuts, because sometimes it's not enough to just work hard, you got to work smart. So if a shortcut is ethical, if something is a wise way of achieving something, right? Like that's why you see many of these advanced countries, these industrialized societies, they are more prosperous than some of these developing countries, because the developing countries depend so heavily on human manpower to achieve things. But many of these developed countries depend on technology and machines. Machines give you leverage. They amplify what you're able to do. That's working smart to increase your productivity. But don't try to get ahead by doing things wrong. The thing is, you may think you're getting ahead, but you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot long term. Like, for example, you see people, they're just like, in fact, believe it or not, I've heard this complaint with my podcast that, man, Divine sometimes tends to be long-winded. You know, Divine, just get to your point. You don't have to explain all these extra stuff. To explain this simple concept, why are you doing a 35-minute podcast? Well, the thing is, I'm trying to help you long term. I'm not just looking at, helping you short term. Just throw the facts at me, let me learn it and move on. No. Many resources can help you with that. You can go and use those resources. But I don't want to just help you memorize information. I want you to understand so that the information is useful for you on a long term basis. So that's why you may think, Divine is long-winded, because I try to many times try to explain things from first principles to help you understand. The thing is, in the long run, you're going to get ahead better by learning the material at this depth than just memorizing a bunch of facts and associations. That's the thing. Like with my review courses, you want to learn facts and associations, then you don't want to be. My courses are not for you. If you really want to learn things deeply and be able to apply them and use them in inventive ways, then you want to get this understanding down pat. That's why my podcasts on average are longer for the same topic than most resources. But again, it's for your own good. So don't just look at the short term. Like, for example, even the USMLEs, don't just look at your score. Like, your life is not defined by your score. Your life is also defined by how well you take care of patients, by how knowledgeable you are, because you see some people, they're so good with their test scores, but they're just awful clinicians because, again, they didn't really learn things well the first time. So don't be that kind of person, because, again, I'm telling you this, especially in competitive environments. Sometimes competitive environments can breed unethical behaviors in people where they begin to do just things that are just not right to get ahead. So please just be careful. Be careful, right? You may get this promise of a high score by doing some unethical thing, but don't do it. It's not worth it. It's not worth your future. And the thing is, you may be surprised that your knowledge, your scores that were acquired in a faulty way, where you don't have true understanding, you end up hurting people in the end. You end up hurting people in the end. Because, maybe there was some fact that you had to understand deeply. But man, you didn't understand it deeply, but you still went about things the wrong way. You achieved your scores. And please don't think that, going about things the wrong way just means cheating or anything like that. No. But going about things the wrong way may just mean you just memorizing things instead of understanding, right? And then you did not understand that material well, but you passed your exams, you moved ahead with your life. But then there's one person that passes away down the line because you took care of them in a way where you did not even realize. Don't get me wrong, people make mistakes. But there are some mistakes people make because they literally just don't have the knowledge. You don't want to be in that kind of situation. You want to minimize. I'm not saying you may be able to completely eliminate that. But you want to try to minimize those kinds of situations where you end up harming a person because you did not have the understanding. When in the past or at some point in your past, you had the opportunity to acquire that understanding. So I would just really encourage you, like, put in the work. It's more work. Don't get me wrong. Is it more work or more effort to listen to a podcast where, wow, to talk about CPAP or PEEP, this person took these many minutes? Yeah. But the thing is this something that would be personally beneficial to you down the line? It will. I'm telling you, there are people that pass away every year because some medical person did not understand what they were doing. They just followed some guideline. They just followed some algorithm. They just followed some pathway. They just followed some charts they memorized from some QBank. And they have no understanding, right? Like, for example, sometimes I work with people one-on-one and I've explained to them that it's not every cause of hypoxia that is treated with supplemental oxygen. Believe it or not, there are some cases of hypoxia that are worsened by giving oxygen. I'm not going to go into those here. That's not the point of this podcast. But I just want you to really, I want you to see the importance of truly knowing your stuff. When you know your stuff, well, one, you're going to do well on exams, but you're seeing beyond doing well on exams. You're seeing beyond doing well on exams. I'm trying to be careful what I'm saying here because of the legal ramifications of things. I don't want to say, oh, use this podcast to make medical decisions. No, this podcast is for educational purposes. But I think you can see intrinsically why having understanding will help you long term as a person in medicine. That's what I'm going to leave it at. So please just go about things the right way. Delay gratification, even if it takes you more work, more effort, but it's going to be worthwhile in the end. Even if there is one patient across your career that does not die because you truly understand what you're doing, that's reason enough to put your nose in the books and learn this material well. Because that patient that dies is someone's husband, someone's dad, someone's grandpa, someone's brother, someone's son, someone's grandchild. So just kind of put that responsibility on yourself to really learn your information and learn it well. So I'll see you in episode 516. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. Bye for now. Thank you.